Hello and welcome to the Back Page of Video Games Podcast. I'm Samuel Roberts and I'm joined as ever by Matthew Castle.
Oh, hello.
Hey Matthew, how are you doing? Sorry, I keep ambushing you with these introductions.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm into this new introduction, but that's fine.
Okay, I do apologise for that.
Expect the unexpected.
Yes, so rather than embarrassing ourselves further, we'll go into our special guest this week. So this week's guest is veteran journalist and IGN managing editor Rachel Weber, who can be described as a friend of the pod. Rachel, it's so good to have you. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. I'm honoured to be here.
Honoured, yes. I was just, you know, just detecting, you know, I detected no sarcasm whatsoever when you said that. I was like, it cannot be an honour to be on this podcast. Surely not. Surely it's like a tiny bit shameful, but, you know, either way, just happy to have you here. So, yes, how are things going, Rachel? You're based in Chicago area, is that right? Last time I chatted to another member of your household, I believe you're moving to that area. So where are you living these days?
Yeah, we're just kind of on the edge of Chicago, so not quite full suburbs, but we're a little bit too old to be in the beating heart of it either. So, yeah, we're in a nice little apartment.
I did see some photos of your dog in a garden, and I described that as sort of like charmingly suburban, a sort of like the scene that was set was very much in that vein. So sounds like a nicer part of the world to live in. Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, it is, and we've gone like horribly suburban. We have like neighbors we like now. There's like, because it's America, there's street parties in the summer, kids playing outside on bicycles. I'm living in the kind of 90s American dream.
Have you had one of those mad Chicago pizzas?
Yeah, I controversially am not a fan.
I've never had one. I've just seen memes about them.
They're a bit sloppy for me. Like, they seem to be more of a kind of tomato and cheese soup in a bowl. I'm much more of a New York pizza girl, which is, damn, you know, probably enough to get me thrown out of the Midwest.
I've never tried one, but the soup element actually sounds more enticing to me. It feels like that should put me off, but it's actually only enticed me further. So, yeah, I just have to make sure I tick that off at some point, and so I can have some kind of take on the differences between these pizzas.
All I know about Chicago is the mad pizzas and all those bridges that are in films all the time.
Yeah. I mean, that's okay. About as much as I knew before we moved here.
Awesome. So, yeah, it's great to have you, Rachel. So, long-term sort of like future person before you move to different publishers. So, you've worked, you know, like a whole host of places. So, excited to talk to you about your career in this episode. So, to start with a little bit about your early life, what was your way into games when you were young? What role did they play in your young life?
I was desperately obsessed with sort of technology and video games as soon as I knew it was a thing, really. But I didn't actually... We weren't a super well-to-do family. So my first experience of actually owning a machine myself was a Game Boy, which I think I was only able to get because my dad, who was in the military, was posted to Iraq, and he could buy one off like the American stores there for much cheaper. So I got a Game Boy with a bunch of slightly dodgy cartridges. But wow. Yeah, just fell in love with it completely and took it everywhere, played with it all the time, and then as computers became more of a thing in classrooms and, you know, your posh friends would have machines, I was just always desperate to have any chance to play video games I could.
Have you ever seen the mad Gulf War Game Boy at the Nintendo store in New York?
Yeah.
They have famously a Game Boy in a glass case that was, like, partially melted by some explosive or something in Iraq. And, yeah, you can, and apparently it still works. So you can go there and see this, like, slightly kind of melty Game Boy playing Tetris. So,
I'm not surprised. Those things were really solid bricks. Like, I think back now, I sort of, I think it's part of getting older, but I'm incredibly nostalgic at the moment. And I do think back to just how pleasingly chunky that old Game Boy was.
Very aesthetically satisfying objects. Could you remember what the cartridges were, Rachel, the dodgy cartridges?
I mean, I definitely had kind of, you know, the Tetris and Super Mario just standard, but then I had ones that were kind of 16 games in one that you had to flip on and off. And I was just a kid, so it was almost entirely random which game you would end up playing, because you just kind of wanted to play a video game and would turn it on and off a few times. But yeah, so there was, you know, there was Kirby and Dr. Mario and I think Castlevania, and but it was really, yeah, it was Mario, Tetris, and then later on Zelda. That was really the obsession in our household.
Oh, nice. Aww. Yeah, I think everyone knew some kid who had like dodgy cartridges. I knew this kid who went to just going to put like square brackets, some islands where they sell dodgy video games, holiday islands. And came back and told me, I've got Sonic on the Game Boy. And I was like, there's no such thing. And then he showed me this this like slightly dodgy Sonic fan game playing on his Game Boy. And that's, yeah, I feel that's a very kind of like real part of being a 90s kid, is being exposed to piracy in all these like various sort of like weird ways. But yeah, that's cool. So did you have much exposure to games media when you were younger? Did you encounter games magazines in the wild?
I remember when we got our first kind of home computer. This is how old I am. We lived in a house that did not have a computer for a long time, but we got an Atari ST 1040, I want to say. And really the only games we had for that were ones that came with the magazines. There's lots of very serious articles in there, but there was also quite often gaming-related stuff, at least somewhere in it, and I would access it that way. It wasn't really until I was kind of, yeah, like 17, 18, that I would get exposed to that stuff. I used to work in, like, the village store, so I would sometimes, you know, just read copies, because I didn't have a PlayStation 1 until I was kind of, yeah, 17, 18, so the idea of kind of buying a gaming magazine didn't really occur to me until I actually had the console that it would be useful for. But yeah, so demo discs on things like, you know, PC of the Month or Atari User.
Yeah, exactly. The magazines were just never understood why they weren't wholly about games. So I was like, well, what's the point of it then? That's kind of like, that's my sort of perspective on that. But I'm curious then to dig into that period where you did more seriously get into games and you got a PS1. What were your key techs when you did get into games? What shaped your tastes?
It was really, you know, we had Tekken. I was big into Tekken on the PlayStation 1, mainly because it just was so insane. You know, you had characters that you could have, like a panda bear and things like this, and I'd never been really exposed to like that kind of game before. So I hadn't been aware of that kind of the real Japanese culture of video games at that time. So all that stuff with, you know, the cutscenes in Tekken blew my mind. We had Tomb Raider, which is a classic, you know, female adventurer. Resident Evil, but the ones that were really had a huge impact on me were Silent Hill on the PS1, because I just, again, like I loved horror and I loved spooky things. I was that kind of kid, real popular. Just that kind of horror and that kind of sensation from a video game just completely was like nothing I'd seen before, and so I was obsessed with that and found it genuinely frightening. And then Final Fantasy VII, which I know is a cliche, but honestly to me, I think a boy told me about it. Shout out to Tom. A boy, when I was, yeah, really young, told me about it. He was obsessed with it. And I think my parents had to like order it from the game shop or something. And Final Fantasy VII came and it was on multiple discs. I remember the whole family gathered round to like look at the opening cutscene of that. Again, just the idea that video games could be like that epic and that kind of size. And that deeper story just, yeah, fascinated me. But, yeah, it was much beloved, my PlayStation 1. I had to share it with my little sister, who's 2 years younger than me. So we had it set up in the dining room. So I'd get home from school and sort of pull a dining chair up to this, like, tiny portable television in the corner to play my PS1.
Oh, that's quite sweet. I mean, the idea of a whole family standing around to watch the opening FMV to FF7, that's like, yeah, what a specifically
that's
90s experience. Yeah. There, so, yeah.
It sort of sounds like when people would get their sort of families and neighbours round for the first sort of, it's the what, we've got the first wireless on the street.
Or the I know, first kind the of Apollo TV, landing, except come and see it on in Technicolor.
Get the neighbours round, Sephiroth is on TV.
Well, it was, I think my dad is very much a, you know, had he been born in a different generation, I think would be a more hardcore gamer than I am.
Right.
And my mum was just happy to be excited about whatever we were excited about, really.
Oh, that's nice.
That's nice.
Okay, so curious where you go from there then, Rachel, in terms of the games you seek out. So Silent Hill is a key tech. So do you follow that series onto PS2? Is Silent Hill 2 a big deal for you as well? What about 3 and 4?
Yeah, I remember when I went to uni, I spent the kind of overdraft I got from the bank when you go to the uni in the UK, and I bought a PlayStation 2 and Silent Hill. Those were my first very responsible purchases, which, given my career, actually, good investment. But yeah, I mean, just the Silent Hill series has stayed with me. I'm absolutely, you know, I really, really want this, the new one that they're doing, to bring back some of that weirdness, because I think there was such a strange existential darkness to the Silent Hill games that I think in the year of our Lord 2024 is actually quite apt, and probably was more apt than in the kind of slightly more optimistic early 2000s. But yeah, I mean, I'm the same as most people, I think. I loved them all up until it was it The Room, Silent Hill 4? And then, it, you know, that was also obviously kind of a weird tangent. It was one of those, a bit like the Cloverfield movies, you know, the game existed before they slapped the Silent Hill tag on it. And you could sort of feel that. But yeah, I played the demo for the new one. I'm hopeful. I'm looking forward to kind of hearing the siren a lot and, you know, bits of the landscape sort of disappearing like flakes of ash. But yeah, it just, I mean, and it's my taste in horror as well, I think. I very much like that kind of strange, really occult horror. So it's hard to know, but it's a bit of a chicken or the cursed egg. I don't know which came first, whether I've just always been drawn to that or Silent Hill made such an impression that it warped me for good.
I think you can tell there is a level of sophistication to that series that doesn't exist elsewhere in survival horror at that time, right? We did an episode about the PS1 recently, and I think Resi is kind of sophisticated in its own way, but Silent Hill just feels like it's drawing from a slightly richer pool of references, you know? So I think there is a reason those games still have such a reputation all these years later. And like you say, they still stand the test of time in a way that maybe not all games from that era do. So yeah, that completely tracks. So I want to ask you a bit more about uni, actually. So you went to university in Bath. Obviously, you'd end up working there too. And I do always stalk LinkedIn for these episodes, so I do apologise for that. But what is your connection to Bath, or what led you to Bath for uni?
Much to my parents' like absolute horror, in the year before we had to like put down our uni selections on the magical form that you have to send off to the British government to say where you want to go to uni, we had visited Bath for my grandparents' wedding anniversary, because my grandparents on my dad's side actually met there. And I just really loved the town. I think it had like, you know, it had a lot of bookshops, and it seemed very kind of literary to me. I was very pretentious at that age. And, you know, I loved the kind of the oldie worldy feel of it. And when it came time to choose a uni, we went to like, obviously all the open days. I also went to like Warwick and a couple of others to have a look. But Bath, I really liked the sound of their kind of English and creative writing programs. And so when it actually came out to fill out the form, my parents, you know, oh, did you send it off? I was like, yeah, I did. They're like, oh, which unis did you put? And it's, you know, traditional, obviously, to put a uni and then some backups. And I was like, oh, just Bath Spa Uni. I just decided I only want to go to that one, which caused much horror. But luckily, I did get in. So,
wow. Amazing. Yeah. So you said that without telling them first. It was already gone when they asked that question. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. I feel like that says a lot about you as a person, you know. You decide something and maybe that's what's going to happen, you know. That's the kind of impression I get there. But yeah, that's cool. So I guess, like, first of all, was Bath as literary as you dreamed it would be in when you were applying for it? And then what led you from uni to working at Future?
I think it was. I mean, Bath's very, you know, if anyone hasn't visited, and I'm sure that's a large majority of people, it's sort of almost freakishly literary and British. You know, it's where they film, obviously, all the scenes from Bridgerton and all the Austen stuff. And you do have the Austen Society there and people wandering around dressed as Mr. Darcy during the Austen Festival and stuff. So it was. And I think it was a good city for, like, a girl who had only really ever lived in kind of a small English village for most of her life. Like, Bath's a really good beginner's city. Like, Bath doesn't really have a bad bit. You just kind of swan around being, you know, sort of privileged and a bit dumb, and you'll get away with it, really. But yeah, I kind of, you know, tale as old as time, I met a boy in my final year, well, in my first year of uni, but after I finished uni, kind of, there wasn't really the idea that I would go home again, like a lot of my friends did. So I stayed in Bath and got, you know, the absolutely classic, I've graduated, what the hell do I do now job of working for a recruitment company for a while. But I had been aware while I was at uni, I'd been very, very aware that, oh my God, there's people here that write about video games as a job. And it really never occurred to me that you could combine, you know, writing, which I loved, with this passion I had for video games, but I would actually see, you know, the official PlayStation magazine people who I read a lot because I finally had a machine. I would see them out and about in town, you know, at different bars. And, you know, they're not celebrities to a lot of people, but they basically were to me. And I was like, oh my God, that would be amazing. But yeah, as soon as I got out of uni, it was more like I need to pay all these things called rent and council tax. So I got a job in recruitment, and I was doing that for years, actually, about 5 years before I actually, you know, went to an interview at Future Publishing and got that job as a staff writer on official PlayStation magazine.
That's awesome. Yeah, so you started a little bit, I think, close to when Matthew started on Endgamer, actually, so similar generation of writers. So I suppose I will ask a bit more about you reading OPM before that. So I guess, like, what... So the PS2 sounds like it was a major moment for you. Silent Hill aside, what were your sort of, like, the key games? What was kind of making you passionate about PlayStation? And was that, like, your number one thing when applying for a job in games media? Were you like, it has to be this magazine?
I mean, I think I would have applied for anything, but it definitely felt like sort of fate, you know, that was the job that came up first, and that I was in the kind of the right place at the right time to apply for. Because I also read, you know, I read Edge was gorgeous, and I would basically read anything I could get my hands on, but they weren't cheap, those magazines. So yeah, it was mainly PlayStation, and I really liked the kind of, which I think exists less in magazines today. Some websites do it really well, but the feeling that they were a kind of a cool gang, that you had a real sense of their personalities in the magazine, you know, and who they were. And that really appealed to me. And yeah, there was definitely a feeling of like, oh, I want to be in this gang where video games are cool and we all just hang out and talk about GTA or Tony Hawk or, you know, whatever we've been playing.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So you started on OPM at the beginning of the PS3 era, end of the PS2 era. It's a period of time we talked about loads on this podcast, but it's quite an interesting sort of flail moment for Sony. It's like a really key part in the history when you think about how the PS4 ends up in the generation afterwards. But what was it like joining the magazine at that point?
Yeah, it was a bit overwhelming because, yeah, I went and applied, and kind of it was a little bit vague about official, you know, being which magazine it was. I think they maybe didn't even have, they were still negotiating the license. So it was like, oh, you'll be working on a PlayStation project. And then it turned out to be official PS3. But it was that strange thing of the, so much of it was in theory at first, because we didn't get a machine until, and we only got one till it launched in Japan, which I think was a few months ahead of the UK. So we had like this one PS3 in the office with very limited games for it, that we would just kind of all hover around as if it was the Ark of the Covenant or something. And other people would come and look at it. And at the same time, we were still covering a lot of PS2 stuff because, you know, you had to sort of have things in the magazine. But yeah, it was a really exciting time, a really strange time. Sony sort of felt a bit, I don't want to say cartoonish. There's always been this weird thing with Sony of like really nailing things like marketing and design and being the cool kids, but then also fumbling in the biggest ways as well. So, you know, it was the era of the giant enemy crab and things like that that felt sort of strange. But yeah, I mean, I was just so excited to be there. It would be a long time before I could afford a PS3 of my own, but just getting to be around people who are excited about the same thing and talking about the thing I loved all day was a big bonus for me.
What was working on OPM like then in those early years of the PS3, and what do you remember as the games that mattered in that era?
It was definitely a time of kind of high excitement and a feeling that we were, that like big things were happening and games were becoming, at least as, I think PS2 had been really cool. It had been going a long time. There'd been some amazing stuff on it. But I feel like PlayStation 3 was really when you started to see a kind of, I don't want to say new generation because that's a cliche in the games world, but there was kind of a really big step up, I feel like, from PS2 to PS3 in terms of the depth of the games and what they could look like visually, and a sense that, you know, games were becoming projects that could be, in the right circumstances, kind of akin to movies in terms of cultural cachet and, you know, size and budget and things. So it was really fun to be working on OPM then, because there would be sort of games you would hear about or things you would get kind of the first look at and be like, oh my God, this is, you know, this is going to be a huge thing. And then there were things that you thought were going to be a huge thing that just did absolutely nothing. But it was also a time of kind of, I think, creativity as well. Like if you think about, you know, Little Big Planet came out and Bioshock and Skyrim later on and things. There was just so many big games doing incredible things and in very, very different ways. The Uncharted series, you know, and it felt like PlayStation 3 had it all really at one point. It had like, you know, all the big kind of, the really big kind of special exclusive games. It had like stuff that you would actually want to play with your friends. Like, you know, it was the era of SingStar and Rock Band and things like that. So yeah, it really felt like, oh, we're the cool kids.
I can definitely attest to occasionally being invited to Kim Richards' flat for SingStar parties, which were mostly like official PlayStation people who I didn't really know that well. Like, I didn't really sort of, there wasn't much kind of cross-pollination, but it always felt quite kind of, oh, exciting. This is where all the cool magazine people are with their karaoke and their confidence at being able to sing in front of people. That was very much my read on it.
Yeah, I think there was definitely a feeling of, yeah, we were kind of, we got to do a lot of really cool things. And, you know, and you've got to remember, like, I'm sure this will chime for a lot of people. When you're the kid that loves, like, weird stuff and video games, like, you don't really grow up feeling like the hot shit, you know. You don't that's not something that you like. It's not like being really good at football or the hottest girl in school, right? The fact that you love video games isn't something to be necessarily that you're, you know, your aunt boasts about at family events. But there was something about, yeah, being on PlayStation at that time where, you know, PlayStation games were doing very well. There was loads of stuff to write about. You know, you were hanging out with people that kind of got you, you know, for some people, I think maybe for the first time. And when you went to a party, you wanted to do the things you wanted to do. So like, you know, SingStar and, yeah, playing some, you know, plastic drums. Like, it was a really fun little gang. And it was, you know, I think for a lot of us, the kind of, that was when we felt our coolest, really.
That's cool. So what were the different roles you performed on the magazine over time? You start as a staff writer, sort of like, where do you go from there? And how did you find your relationship with the magazine sort of like evolved over time? And I suppose like in relation to PS3 games as well, because I think like my memory of that generation is it starts a bit bumpy for Sony, but it starts to pick up a bit around the halfway point. And then by the end, it's kind of got a roster of games that are about as good as Xbox. But I was curious to hear what you made of it.
Yeah, I would massively agree with that. And I think, I mean, I started, you know, as a staff writer, it was my first job doing anything sort of professionally editorial. I was terrible. Mainly because, I mean, I remember my first ever review, I think, like maybe 3 months after I started, my boss said, "How do you think it's going?" And I burst into tears, which was an apt review, honestly, because the blank page terrified me so much. And it was so absolutely the job I wanted that, you know, I would sit down to write a review of, like, you know, a Medal of Honor game and be like, war, you know, just like, I was so overwhelmed by it. So as a staff writer, there was, you know, you're also put on a lot of weird little projects. So, you know, the staff writer would be the person that was like, oh, review this Onimusha game or this, you know, Dragon Ball or whatever. And because, you know, that was maybe only going to get like 100 words in the magazine. So you were, in some ways it was really good for me because you were bouncing around and having to learn very quickly about sort of different games and genres and things that you'd never would have picked up maybe if you were doing entirely what you liked. But yeah, it was a big thing of it was confidence. But I must have gotten over that because I did eventually kind of become the news editor, which was kind of fascinating. And I am really glad I did that because, you know, this was magazines. Like, this is, it's so strange now to think of, now that I work on, you know, I've worked on websites for so long, like trying to do news for a magazine in a time when the internet was becoming increasingly the place where people got their news. And, you know, you knew that your magazine was going to come out basically a month after you sent it off. So it was really good for me to have to really learn what news was and how news would last and other places to get news. You know, we couldn't really rely on getting a press release or some images anymore from the big publishers. Exclusives were becoming less and less of a thing because, you know, even if you had the exclusive images in the UK, another territory might have it earlier, put it online, and then, you know, it sort of lost its value. So that was, I think, really good for me. And I was still able to do a lot of kind of reviews and features and things like that. And I remember when I was sort of given that position, I didn't really want it because I thought news would be really difficult. We specifically had a format that meant we had 10 news stories, you know, the big 10 at the front of a magazine. So knowing I would have to find 10 things a month, I wasn't sure when I first took the job, but actually I learned to really love it. And it was, I think, really helped me develop some skills that otherwise I would have been able to kind of just sit back and, you know, write thinky features.
I always thought that 10 things was the solution to news in magazines, because it sort of editorialized it so much by making it like these are the 10 things that matters, no less, no more. It kind of let you elevate things into the status of news just by their inclusion, because you're like, well, this is one of the 10 things that we think matters. And definitely when we redesigned Endgamer into Nintendo Gamer, obviously Tim Clark was editor-in-chief or head publishing person, where I can't remember the role, and I think brought over some of that 10 things thinking to our kind of front section, and it was just like just a godsend. You know, I've always thought that was really, really strong, and, you know, I was very sort of envious of it.
Yeah, I believe he stole it from Grazia. I don't think he'll mind me saying
right.
that. I think it was, ladies' lifestyle magazine Grazia still has, I think, their sort of 10 news stories at the front. But it was great, you know, because you had like 10 buckets to fill, and some, you know, the month of E3, that was easy. And then other months you really had to kind of, I was a great one for stalking DeviantArt, because there wasn't even like, you know, that much social media. You couldn't just sort of wait around and see what was going viral on Twitter. So I used to, you know, be on DeviantArt looking for cosplayers, or deep in Reddit, you know, looking for people that were doing like cool things. But just a brilliant grounding in that kind of finding stuff that's cool.
Were you on news when the God of War GOAT stuff happened?
I was, yeah. That was a tough time in the office. Because, you know, we were sort of very aware that the stakes were pretty high on that. And, you know, one of the things about being our little gang was that, you know, we were all very kind of, we were friends who hung out outside of, so we were very aware of, like, you know, the pressure on the editor at the time, Tim Clark, and the general kind of, oh God, like what's happened. I mean, looking back, it was insane. Like looking back at, you know, there was, you know, the goat pictures and the topless women, and like, of course it caused a bit of a stir, you know, I think. But at the time we were just like, oh, this is mad. Like, we should put this in the magazine. But it was obviously a difficult couple of weeks, and it was not something you could joke about either for a long time in the office. It was not, you know, it was a very, very sore spot.
Maybe joked about it on our side of the office.
I'm sure. But yeah, we were very kind of, but it's funny, you know, because I was looking for it the other day. I was trying to explain, because, you know, one of the lead architects of that drama I now live with. And I was trying to sort of explain it to someone in the family this time this mad thing happened, and I was looking for it online, and it, you can kind of find scans, but it's not as easy to find as you would think. And I think if that had happened, you know, a few years later, maybe we wouldn't have got away with it, because it would have been a lot harder to kind of suppress it. I mean, as it was, I think they went and they took any copies that hadn't gone out, the printers literally cut it out with a scalpel.
Wow.
So all these issues went out with a couple of pages missing, because I remember it was my job to, if someone was, you know, annoyed that they were missing the story that was on the back page of the goat story, you know, we had to send them like a PDF or whatever.
Oh, wow.
So I dealt with that. I dealt with that, you know.
Demand my story.
I'm not sure everyone would have kept their jobs, honestly, if that had happened now.
Damn. It's like my grandma removing page 3 from my granddad's newspaper. Very similar vibes. Wow. That's sort of, an amazing thing to work through. And I do agree. I echo what Matthew says. I think that maybe Grazia started it, but the cascading effect of that 10 things approach to news, that kind of almost like mini feature section. When you read Empire now, it's the same thing, basically. It's like they're making news. They're using micro interviews or pulling out smaller things. And yeah, I think OPM was way ahead of the curve on that one. So I suppose like what leads to the end of your OPM time?
I mean, I think as in, you know, most companies, but especially magazines, I think, well, for one thing, you know, magazines were becoming smaller and smaller teams. I definitely felt ready to kind of go off and do something else. I would have loved to move up at OPM, but it becomes people all sort of kind of vying for very similar small set of top jobs. And I still loved my job, but I'm a terrible one for getting, once I find something fairly comfortable, I get a bit bored. So I went and actually interviewed for a position at Eurogamer. I think it was features editor, which I didn't get. But they said, hey, but we'd really like you to come on as a member of gamesindustry.biz, which my reasoning reaction was, no, that's, you know, I don't want to do the boring business stuff. But, you know, I spoke to a few friends who kind of understood that I was a bit frustrated. And they said, well, why don't you do it for a year and just see how, you know, see how it goes. You'll have got some different experience under your belt. You know, you'll spend some time in a different gaming publishing network, and then I was there for a few years actually.
Yeah, a pretty cool transition to make. I think a lot of people who've ended up at GI.biz have gone onto like a bunch of cool stuff, so I can see why that made sense. And going from print to online as well, probably a good moment to do that. Are there any key issues of OPM that defined your time working on the magazine, or any you reflect on fondly?
I mean, I think that one of the things that was nice that we don't get to do anymore, and this sounds incredibly vain, but there was a couple of stories we did where we had a bit more budget. So one of them was for Red Dead Redemption. We did a huge cowboy photo shoot where, which is, it seems insane now that, you know, that I was dressed as a saloon wench, and then we had a couple of the guys dressed in cowboy outfits. I can't even remember like why we were doing a photo shoot to go with a video game that I assume had screenshots, but that was good fun, just as kind of getting to play dress up and feeling, you know, like we were on PlayStation's next top model.
Yeah, like the idea of Dan Houser opening that issue and being like, you know, reading the preview then seeing those photos and being like, what on earth, you know?
Yeah, I want to believe that not, happened. Yeah, this is a bunch of nerds dressed in Western gear. This was not what I paid for. But yeah, I think in terms of ones that I enjoyed, I remember really enjoying doing the Lost review, because I got to absolutely pan it. And by then I was pretty confident. And I remember just thinking, God, like sitting down to write that just felt so easy compared to when I'd first started. I remember it really sticking out to me as, I'm really enjoying writing this. I'm getting loads of jokes in. Yeah, and I'm actually having fun. That was a big, I think, mental moment for me. And then there was a few other things, because as, you know, as OPM grew, we were sort of experimenting with, there was a video, PlayStation Access, a kind of video service that was, again, looking back, sort of like weirdly before its time, but also not, that was, you know, you could download it on your PlayStation, a kind of almost video podcast thing. And for that I would write features to go within the magazine as well, but there was one where I learned to rap. That was to go with the Def Jam game. I'd come back from a demo of Def Jam, kind of bragging that I'd been really good at it. It was like, it was SingStar for rap. Came back saying I'd been really good at it, and immediately regretted it, because people started talking about, oh, well, wouldn't it be funny to get Rachel, this incredibly British 5'5" white girl, to become a, you know, maybe we could make her a rapper. And so it sort of turned into this nightmare scenario for me of... They found like I think his name was like Mr. XO, like a proper, like pretty well respected London rapper to kind of train me. And I had to come up with a rap and an alias. And then I had to go up in front of a bunch of sort of music industry people and get reviewed by them. It was honestly horrible. Like, but I'm such a people pleaser, I couldn't say no. But it was like a nightmare. You know, when you kind of, I'm in the exam, I'm naked, I didn't go to this class all year. That feeling. But it was very, very funny. So I did say,
yeah. Do you remember what your alias was?
Oh, God, it was MC Cupcake. yeah, and it was kind of a diss track. It is somewhere on YouTube. I have yet to watch it because I can't. It's too shameful for me. But that was fun. And then another thing we did that was slightly less fun, but I did get some good Facebook photos out of it, was for the relaunch of the Fear game, they dressed me up as Alma, like full zombie makeup, about a ton of sort of styling wax in my hair, and then I had to stand around in central London on Oxford Street, and they took videos of people being freaked out. But then the problem with that was they'd made me look truly hideous, but by the time we were sort of finished with the photo shoot for the day, and we had to go back to Bath, the makeup artist had left, and it was properly sort of stage-worthy film set makeup that did not come off with, you know, soap and water. You needed like sort of proper, I think you had to use like a mixture of babe oil and stuff, which we didn't have. You know, we maybe had some like, you know, makeup removing wipes we bought from Boots that weren't cutting it. So I had to travel back on the train to Bath, fully zombied. Which I didn't love. I'm not a person who enjoys that kind of attention. So yeah, that was kind of a crazy time. But there was lots of things like that I just was very specific to magazines, because you were constantly thinking about, you know, the images and the layout of the page, and kind of as much as you were the words. And yeah, those were really good fun times.
That's cool.
I like the idea of someone being on the train thinking, oh, MC Cupcake looks unwell.
yeah, I mean, it was disgusting. Like, I think it took about 7 washes on my hair to get this amount of wax they put in it to make it look all kind of ratty. And I was cold as well. Yeah, it was a strange time.
It has the energy of Sean Bean climbing a mountain in his Boromir costume, because he didn't want to get in the helicopter. So it's just like Sean Bean dressed as Boromir climbing a mountain, like anything for the job, basically. I do appreciate that. And I will be tracking down that video, Rachel, because I would like to see MC Cupcake at work. It sounds like a very bizarre episode of Faking It on Channel 4. So
it was exactly like that, yeah. Shamefully.
Okay, awesome. So, like you say, you moved to gamesindustry.biz. I've always assumed that's like following a parallel track to the rest of games media, but it does open up some different types of opportunities. What was it like for you?
Yeah, it was a first in a lot of ways for me, because it was fully remote, which was actually pretty rare at that time. So yeah, I was working from home, and suddenly I had to be more focused on the business side of the industry, as you might imagine, which I'd never been interested in, honestly. You know, I've never been one of those people that kind of was obsessed with how the sausage was made. Like, I loved video games. I loved going on trips to see the studios and like, oh, here's the artist making a thing. Loved all that. But in terms of, and here's Gary from monetization, that wasn't really anything that, you know, got my heart racing. But there I was in the middle of kind of, it was really the big time of in-game transactions were a big thing. Like, everything was going mobile. Every big studio, even like Ubisoft and stuff, was interested in how they could, you know, make mobile pay for them. So a lot of people were bringing out iPhone versions of their big franchises and trying to figure out how to make that happen. And, you know, Candy Crush was like the biggest thing back then. So, and Farmville, and it was a really interesting time. Games were definitely going through something. So being able to be there for that, I think, gave me an understanding that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And it meant that I had to get really confident talking to CEOs. You know, when you're working on sort of the more consumer side, you obviously like do a lot of interviews and you might get some time with a studio head or something, but this was much more, you were basically only talking to kind of studio heads or CFOs or people like that they just wouldn't even let you get close to if you were consumer press. But when they had something, a new idea that they wanted to kind of spread the word about on the industry side, we were kind of seen as one of the only ways to get that news out in a way that they could, you know, they knew they were talking directly to their kind of peers. So I got a lot of opportunities to meet people and see the business from a different angle, which I don't think hurt in a lot of ways. It, you know, because I got to spend time with people that, yeah, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to chat with in the same way.
That's cool. Who were some of those people?
Like Riccatiello in the day, and, you know, yeah, definitely Yves Guillemot and people like that that just wanted to get the word out about, oh, we're, you know, pivoting to microtransactions and things in a way that they would never want to talk to a consumer person about how that was going to work money-wise.
Were any of them surprisingly good hangs? Which CEO would you go for a pint with, if any?
Peter Moore.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, now kind of, now, is he owner of Liverpool, manager of Liverpool? But at the time, yeah, EA. And just a really solid bloke, like really good fun to talk to, would always be honest with you, wasn't afraid to have like a bit of an off-the-record chat, actually remembered who you were when you met him at things. So yeah, he was, I still have a lot of love for him. I think he was a real grounding force at EA and was, you know, such a huge part of the industry. Like he'd been around for kind of the Dreamcast era and things. And I'm not surprised he went on to, you know, work in the sports side of things at all.
Yeah, I interviewed him once and he was just remarkably charismatic. I think that sort of thing, he was good for EA in that respect, is a sort of very human, but you say grounding sort of presence between that exec layer and regular people. You know, he's a very much a one-off in the industry. That's really cool. So I did want to ask you, Rachel, before we take a break, about press trips, because I assume you got to take a few coming in as a staff writer in the mid-noughties like we did. Are there any press trips that stood out as being particularly preposterous or fun?
I mean, they blow my mind now, like looking back. I try and tell people about the good old days. They don't want to hear it, but just the amount of money that was flying around. I remember my first, I mean, as well, like I said, we didn't have a huge amount of money growing up. So I think I'd been to America once. I'd literally been to Florida Disneyland, which my parents, bless them, like had saved up forever for. We went for the millennium to go to Disneyland because they wanted to do it before we all left home. So being flown by THQ to San Francisco for a week, an entire week, for basically one afternoon's work where we did a few hands-on, but the rest of it was just fun things like, let's go shopping, let's go to, you know, Japantown, let's go and spend a day at a shooting range. Just, I couldn't believe this life that I was living, or, you know, it was a whole different world to me. I got so overexcited. And this was when the pound was really strong against the dollar as well. So Equally, like, you don't get paid anything as a staff writer. So there was a bunch of things that suddenly I could actually at least sort of afford because we were in the US, you know. So I ended up buying a second suitcase because I got so much stuff while we were there in like Japantown and, you know, the big San Francisco mall. I nearly died because I let this very kind of very old school 90s public relations guy order for me at a steak restaurant, and he ordered for me like the surf and turf and then the chocolate souffle. And I thought I was going to die from the amount of food I ate. I was just like lying on the floor of this this hotel room, just praying for death. But yeah, it's just, and there was a bunch like that. You know, used to go to Montreal pretty regularly to see things. I went to North Carolina to see Epic back in the day. You know, in some ways, there's still some of that around, and there's still, you know, on the entertainment side, that's not unusual. Probably the biggest one, I think, was when I was back at Future for the second time on Games Radar. We got for Fallout 76. See, this is topical. Fallout 76, they flew us to this old hotel in the middle of, God, I don't even remember wherever that game's set.
West Virginia.
Yeah, West Virginia. Right. They took us out to a hotel that actually had a nuclear vault that was designed to be a certain distance from Washington, D.C. So if the bomb went off, they could get, you know, the president there within an hour. And we stayed at this massive sort of sprawling resort hotel and did like a bunch of different activities. They had a Reclamation Day party in the vault. They taught us axe throwing. There was falconry for some reason.
In the vault?
No, not the axe throwing in the falconry. That would have been cruel. They were outside on the huge grounds. But just,
I was going to say, that is misguided.
And again, just for like an afternoon of playing it in some interviews. But I mean, they had to get a, because it was the middle of nowhere, West Virginia, they had to like charter a small private plane to get all these journalists and influencers to this big hotel because there was no kind of commercial flight directly there. It was wild, you know.
Yeah. That's quite a, yeah, quite an infamous, cool press tip to be on. And like you say, yeah, it's a little bit topical looking at the Steam charts, but that's cool. So I do kind of miss the pre-recession press trips, because I kind of understand now why they happened. Because back in the day, right, all they had budget for was some print ads, maybe some online ads. There were no live streams, there were no influencers. So what were you going to spend money on except doing preposterous bullshit with press? It kind of makes sense, but yeah, I do miss those. THQ in particular were quite infamous for ridiculous press trips, so
yeah,
that's cool. Do you get to do much of that these days, Rachel?
I plan to. I haven't recently. That's one of the brutal truths about kind of working your way up in the industry as well. The kind of more responsibility you take on, the less time you have to do that kind of stuff, even if you still want to. But I did recently get to go out to New York to interview Matt Stone about the new South Park game, and that did feel a bit like, ooh, we're doing this again. And I'm looking forward to kind of the summer of gaming and going and seeing, you know, a bunch of games and actually being around people again. That'll be really nice.
That's cool. Yeah, I was kind of fishing for the South Park thing because I did see that go up on IGN. So that's cool. Awesome. Well, we'll take a quick break there, Rachel, and we'll ask you some more questions about the recent years of your career. Welcome back to the podcast. So, got a bunch more questions here we're going to ambush Rachel with, and she'll very kindly answer them. So, Rachel, you moved to the US in 2014, just after I moved to Bath, actually. I only saw you in person very briefly, and then you were gone.
Yeah, don't take that personally.
No, I don't. It was very clear you'd been around for, you know, you've been around for a long time, and it was a big life change, and it was exciting and different, and, you know, that makes total sense. But you're still there 10 years later, and you've made a couple of moves in that time. What was that decision like, and do you ever miss Peasedown St John, where you used to live?
No to Peasedown St John. I miss the people. I miss the fact that in Bath you could kind of stumble into one of three pubs on a weekend and someone you knew would be there, because there was, you know, so many games journalists packed into quite a small town. But no, I mean, yeah, it was a big decision. I was still working from home for gamesindustry.biz, and my partner, Tim Clark, was working on, had just made the move to PC Gamer. And I think they had tasked him with kind of finding someone who would be the linchpin between the US and UK teams to kind of join them up. And I think it sort of occurred to a lot of people during that process that actually he might be the right fit for that. So I spoke to Gamer Network, who were like, oh, well, you know, you will be in America in San Francisco, and yet we won't have to, you know, pay you any different than we're paying you now. Yeah, absolutely do that. So yeah, he went out there for 6 weeks and kind of hung out with the team there. I went to visit him. You know, we loved America and San Francisco, and we thought, oh, we'll do this for a year, a couple of years. It'll be good fun, you know, and then we'll just come home. So we just bought a house, which we rented out fully furnished. And off we went, thinking we'd be back in a couple of years. And life just, as always, kind of came in and decided to mess that up. Because just as we were planning, you know, we basically set a date for going back. We were looking at how the hell we were going to get, you know, our dog back and get our, you know, move back into our house when we got home. And I got completely out of the blue a phone call from John Davison, who I'd never met in person, and he said, oh, you know, I'd like to speak to you about a job opportunity. And I'm never one to say no to that kind of thing, because you know, you never know what it'll be. And I went to meet him and Simon Cox, who was he was working with in a San Francisco bar, and they said, oh, we're doing a new project and it's Rolling Stone, and, you know, we'd like to have you on board. And I obviously immediately lost my mind and had to sort of call Tim on walking. I mean, I was only 10 minutes from our apartment, but I just called him and said, we're not going home, because it was such a dream, you know. I was already imagining myself as, you know, in the Cameron Crowe movie, almost famous, but for video games. So, yeah, so we, you know, then we stayed. And whilst that project, Glixel, for Rolling Stone, only, you know, didn't really last that long, once we sort of decided to stay in the US for a bit, every year we stayed, it just kind of got easier to stay another year. And we've just been doing that, really. Every year we kind of think about it, but so far we've been enjoying it enough to do another year of being American.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, you know, you went from San Francisco to New York, and like you say, now in Chicago, you know, very exciting, I can imagine. But when you moved to the US, I remember you mentioning you missed M&S. Is there anything else about...
I still do.
Is there anything in the US that kind of like gets vaguely close to that? Like, what's the farmers thing or whatever it's called? Is that kind of close? Or is there anything else about the UK you missed?
You know, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of things to love here. Like, I love Target, but... there's just nowhere in America that you can get a pair of pants and a really posh ready meal in the same shopping trip, you know?
Yeah.
They don't have the same culture of like, it's a ready meal, but it's a bit fancier. I think because in America, eating out is so much cheaper that if you were going to go to that bother, like go to a restaurant and order a takeout. The idea of sort of going and buying one of 50 posh sandwiches is not their thing, really. But yeah, I mean, I've come to love a lot of things about America. I still get incredibly homesick just when I see, you know, a movie like Paddington 2 or something. I do still miss the UK, and I think there'll always be a kind of... just the minute I land in the UK, like, I know how everything works. I'm on home turf. I know all the shops, I know what I'm doing. There's like a cultural ease that I have in the UK that I think in the US you just get used to things being a bit different, but they never feel quite the same. So I remember struggling with things like all the brands are a bit different. So, you know, you go to buy like washing up liquid and you're like, there's no Fairy. What's the equivalent of Fairy in the US? Or going to, you know, Trader Joe's and there being seven types of tomatoes and wanting to burst into tears because I was like, I just want tomatoes. I don't know what this is. So it's gotten easier, but the culture shock to start with was a lot. I think a lot more than we were expecting because, you know, it's the same language. We know American culture. But just once you actually have to like live somewhere and figure all that stuff out, it's a bit of an effort. But yeah, I mean, now it's easy. But yeah, I still go home and, you know, I still go home and I get my Marks and Spencer's prawn mayonnaise sandwich and a pile of magazines and some, you know, like a twirl or something. And that's my... my little welcome back to the UK.
Starter pack, yeah.
Did you find any cultural differences on like the teams you worked with in terms of like covering games in the UK and covering them in the US? I would imagine not, but there are certain things where certain games or certain series mean more to Americans, or they grew up with a certain experience and people in the UK grew up with a certain experience. And, you know, I have wondered if there is anything in that, or if it's just... like the business is just so universal these days that everything feels the same.
Actually, like, I found it to be really different and still do in a way, because for one thing, until you know, I think live in America, as a British person, it's almost impossible to get your head around how big the US is. Like, just the sheer size of the country and the, you know, you've got different coasts on different time zones, you know. Like, imagine if, you know, like Birmingham... and Bath were on completely different, you know, clocks. It's that kind of thing is strange. And so I think in the UK, it was much easier to maintain relationships with kind of the marketing and the PR teams and people within the industry that were also in the UK, because it was so small. That was like a handful of people.
Right.
And they knew you and you knew them. And, you know, there wasn't that many places in the UK that big offices were based that covered games. So, you know, something like an EA could come to the Bath office, see six gaming magazines in a day. So you would see a lot of the same people over and over again, writers and, you know, press people at the same events. So I think there was a lot more of a kind of collegial relationship. Whereas in the US, everything's just bigger. So teams are bigger on websites and things. The number of people who will deal with the press for a big game or company are much bigger. And so it's a lot harder to kind of have those more personal relationships, especially I think when you're starting out, you know, it's... so that was a big thing, sort of learning it, that you're no longer kind of one of a handful you know, you're part of a bigger corporate machine. And then I think there is, and I say this with absolute love for my UK compatriots, but in terms of like on the teams, there's a natural kind of cynicism that is British and is responsible, I think, for a lot of my humour and for why our people are the way they are. Whereas I think in the US there was more, generally I found people to be like more earnest and not afraid to be seen to be earnest about things.
Right.
Which at first is kind of, you have to get used to as a Brit.
Yeah, like, are you doing a bit, you keep saying.
Yeah, you know, yeah, like just be like, oh dude, take it down a notch. But actually, you know, it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of lovely. But yeah, so there was, that was it. It was small things, like little just cultural, you know, misunderstanding, shorthand for things that, you know, the references are different for a lot of things. The humour can be different, so you do have to kind of, I often explain to people that, you know, apologies if I'm a bit sweary in one-to-ones, because most of the people I speak to now are American, and, you know, I try and explain that in the UK swearing is a love language, you know, it's just affectionate, and I apologise if I'm being offensive. So there's, you know, there's little differences like that as well. But yeah, the big thing is just that it's such a huge industry out here that it's a lot harder to get that kind of stake in it, where you feel like you can, you know, you've got people you can call and have a more personal relationship with and get, you know, the kind of background or the, oh no, but tell me honestly, like, what's happening with this? It takes a lot more to earn that trust, I think.
That's really interesting. So I did want to ask a bit more about Rolling Stone, because, you know, like you say, it didn't last a super long time, but I can absolutely see why that was a really exciting opportunity. And loads of good writing came out of that, out of Glixel as well. And so in classic media owner fashion, they didn't seem to have much patience to let it grow. What was that experience like overall?
It was fascinating because, yeah, I was working with an entirely, you know, new group of people, which if you're actually in the games industry, doesn't happen that often, because like we've said, it's, you know, a small industry and you'll often be at least dealing with people you already know. But the group there was completely new to me. There was four of us on the editorial side and a video guy, and we were starting, you know, this new thing. We had like very, very big ideas. It was very exciting. One of the things that was really interesting is how much easier it was to get access to anything once you put a name like Rolling Stone on your email. So things right. that you sort of could struggle to get access to as a sort of a video gaming website or a video gaming magazine. But once you sort of said, oh, well, this will be for Rolling Stone. And the way Glixel worked to start with was we were a separate website, but we would have kind of the stories would also appear on Rolling Stone in some form. On their website. So, you know, people were kind of getting that sort of mainstream attention. So I did, you know, some of the things I did there was I worked on a column where I would just get famous people to talk about the games they loved. And I would just go on IMDb Pro and like look at their publicist and call them and be like, would they want to do this for Rolling Stone? And, you know, that it was really easy to get that as a yes. I got Kojima to write a movie column for us because, again, you know, he wanted to, the idea of being able to review movies for Rolling Stone was appealing to Kojima in a way that, you know, doing it for OPM probably wouldn't have been.
I am shocked to hear that he was into that idea. What an absolutely massive surprise that is to me.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, we were able to get really good writers. We had a kind of in culturally that I think made doing things that were much more in-depth and interesting easier. The people I worked with were as amazing. We had almost a startup energy because there was just this five of us that were creating this thing with this idea that it would grow. Like, we had a big office, but then only, you know, five of us in it, with the sense that, oh, we'll keep hiring and hiring and this will get bigger. And then it became very obvious that Rolling Stone didn't really know what to do with us and was kind of an absentee parent. You know, they never sort of came to us and said, oh, stop doing this or stop doing that. But we would have, yeah, you didn't really feel like, oh, they're, you know, they're really on board with this idea about video games. And I think partly that was because we were I think, a bit of a pet project of Gus Venner's son, who came up with the idea and I think got it happening. And then I believe he moved on to sort of different parts of the business, and we kind of just were quietly let go. And they kept Glixel going for a while. They hired one person to kind of run it. But I think even that only lasted a few months, and then it just quietly went away.
Damn. And Gus Wedder went on to date Elle Fanning. So yes.
I mean, it was my first time being laid off. That was quite an experience. I'd never had that before. So it was, you know, in terms of life experiences, and especially because of some of the stress of being such a small team, the five of us that were kind of, or the five people I was working with, we bonded pretty strongly. And, you know, two of them are still, I still love all of them. And then two of them, one is, I would consider my brother from another mother, that we ended up moving to New York around the same time and we're very close friends with. And then John Davison, who was running Glixel, is my boss again now, so, and a great friend.
Yeah, connections really do can last forever in games, for sure. So I'm pleased that kind of worked out. And I will just underline that, you know, you did all make some really cool stuff over there. It was a great project. It wasn't like a cynical kind of, like, you know, a sort of mainstream channel opens up a games channel and it's not really, you know, all that. It was very much it felt like a full-bodied effort, and they got some really good people, yourself included. So yeah, so you then did the return trip to Future, something I'm familiar with myself. You worked on Games Radar on the US side. Actually, I was just out, Rachel, with Jordan Gerblick on Games Radar at an event, and he had only extremely nice things to say about working with you.
That's very sweet. He was, I hired him on the US side, so he was a, you know, very, very good hire, I think, for us.
He just considered you a gem, I think, and just, holding the whole, one of the kind of, like, you know, glue people holding the entire thing together. So, yeah, he was very kind about you. But they no doubt benefited enormously from your expertise. What impact do you think you had on that site over that six-year period? Because I remember when, in the middle of the last decade, GamesRadar was definitely facing this sort of, like, we're going to be a game site and a pop culture site, and it's a tough transition to make, to do it convincingly, and it's really come out very well for them in terms of, like, the mix of content on the site long term. They got loads of good writers on there. It's like a really well read site, so you were a key part of that. What was it like working on GamesRadar during that period?
Yeah, it was interesting because I feel like when I first came in, the US team, which I was kind of hired to look after, had been sort of slightly forgotten about and left behind. We had, you know, one other person in the office, and we had a couple of freelancers, but it was very much seen as a kind of just this little vestigial limb on Games Radar in the UK, where a lot of stuff was happening. And I think I really credit it to Sam Loveridge, who, she started around the same time as me. We still had Dan Dawkins was running the whole thing, but, you know, Sam Loveridge came on board with this really sort of incredible understanding of, you know, SEO, which I know is a bit of a curse word in our industry, but SEO is a way of, like, knowing what readers wanted and were interested in, rather than some dark art about, you know, tricking people. She had this amazing understanding of reading those kind of runes, and so we were able to kind of really lean into what our readers were excited about. And we were able to sort of get the US team to be a more kind of integrated with the UK side, and worked a lot harder, I think, figuring out what Games Radar was and, you know, where we stood in the kind of sea of all the other gaming publications. Because I think that was one thing. It was, you know, we were kind of cursed and blessed to be a bit of an everything site. So we didn't have the, you know, something like a, you know, PC Gamer has, like, a really clear, you know, if you want to talk to people who like PC games, you come and see us. And Games Radar was a bit more like, well, who are we for? What do we do? And I think we managed to get it to a place where it was like, well, you know, we're this kind of little, if you're into, like, the nerdy stuff, then Games Radar kind of is a pretty easily accessible, not snotty mainstream, or at least mainstream nerd, place to go and get your information about, you know, the big games and Marvel and things like that. Yeah, so, and now, you know, it was really nice to see the numbers grow and to see all the teams starting to work together differently. And yeah, it was, you know, again, it was, you know, I left not because I was unhappy there, but just it kind of, we'd got to a place where it didn't really, you know, it didn't really need me that much anymore. It was doing great.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, after that, you moved to IGN where you are now, first as a product manager, now as a managing editor. How's that been so far? It seems like they have a ton of great writers there these days. So I assume you're just, you know, you're working with like a whole bunch of people day to day. How has that been?
Yeah, I mean, that was wild. I actually had, whilst I was at GamesRadar, another website had contacted me about a position, and I'd gone through a million interviews with them. And then John Davison, I reached out to him for a reference, and he said, oh, well, if you're looking for a job. And I had been a bit burnt out on editorial just because we'd come through the pandemic. You know, if you were any kind of manager during that time, I think you were, especially with a young crew of writers like me and Sam Loveridge had at the time on GamesRadar, you were doing a lot of kind of emotional care as much as you were trying to, you know, get the work done, because for some of those young writers, we might be the only person they spoke to that day. So that was, you know, I was a bit drained. So he, you know, came along and offered this product manager, which I'd never even considered, you know, I'd never even been I wasn't even really sure what product manager did. but, you know, he spoke to me about it and that, you know, it would be someone that was kind of helping come up with new products and sort of features for the site around Game Help. And I thought it sounded really interesting. And I trusted John. Like, if John thought I could do it, I could probably do it. Because he'd, you know, we'd been together on Glixel and we'd stayed in touch. And so, yeah, I did a year of product management, which, you know, I really enjoyed. The people I worked with were amazing. It wasn't really for me because I would get frustrated with some of the sort of corporate processes, but being able to, like, you know, build an AI bot was great fun. And just getting to see how that side of a website works, like, again, not a person who is super interested in how the sausage is made, but actually I think really good for a managing editor to understand how a website works and, you know, what's happening behind the scenes in terms of the tech. So yeah, after about a year of that, then IGN had a managing editor in the past, had decided to try going without one for a little while, and then I think realised, oh no, actually it is good having someone to kind of tie it all together. So it offered me the position, and I've loved it ever since. I mean, I'm back in the thick of it with all the editorial madness and writers, and IGN is just on such a different scale. It's funny because I know IGN because it, you know, is kind of the biggest video games website. We would sort of, you know, not sneer, but we would be like, oh, well, you know, IGN, it's just because they're bigger and they've got, you know, money and things. Mm. But actually having worked there, I'm horrified to discover that, people work really hard. Like, it's not just a scale thing. They're some of the most sort of dedicated writers I've ever worked with in terms of just going the extra mile and really sort of engaging with everything about their particular section of the website and sort of curating it and caring for it. And yeah, I've loved it. I mean, it's chaos, you know, there's always, especially as a managing editor, you're kind of there to fix things when they break and fill gaps and be the kind of hive mind for all the separate department's heads, you know, so news and features, and they may not talk, you know, they don't have that much time to talk to each other. So you're there to kind of be the sort of the glue in the middle. But yeah, I love it. It's so nice to be back in editorial. And I, you know, this is not a position I ever thought I would have. You know, this girl that was crying in front of an empty Medal of Honor review when I was in my early 20s, you know, I never thought I'd be this person on IGN. It still feels a bit weird, but I love it.
If anything, though, you're kind of a rare type of person these days to have in games media, someone who's actually like been around and worked on a whole bunch of different stuff. Like, it feels like games media only loses that expertise rather than gains it over time. So yeah, in that sense, I don't know, you're kind of like one of the, I don't want to say old hands, Rachel, but you know, you're a veteran.
It's fine,
certainly.
I'm 40 now. I think it's not an easy industry to age in, because I think it's very easy to get burnt out. And it's very easy just for, you know, as your life changes. Like, I'm very lucky. I've got a partner who is in the same kind of industry and is also sort of refusing to mature properly the way I am. So, you know, video games are still a huge part of our life and we love them. And my passion for them has never waned. And I still love having a job where I you know, talk about them, and I still log off from looking after a video game website all day to play video games. And I do think, I think it's really easy for that to wane as well. And just, you know, as you have kids or things like that, and you don't have as much spare time, I can see why you would, you know, the passion for actually working on that side of things would be less. So I do feel incredibly lucky, and I do think it is a hard industry to mature into. I think, you know, as you know, Sam, there's a, in the UK, there's a very clear path of journalist to press, which I think makes a lot of sense. You know, I know some people are cynical about it, but who better to know how to communicate with writers and editors than someone who's been there and knows what is needed?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's very easy for people to kind of drift away from it. So I feel very, very lucky that I've been around. And I think part of that is I just refuse to grow up a little bit.
I'm just always like amazed by, I guess, like, you know, both yours and Tim's stamina for staying in it, because I the thing you say about the pandemic is very real, actually. I sort of, like, in some ways I thought, well, I was at a bit of a dead end with my where I was at in media, and I didn't really have any other jobs I was dying to do. And but then now when I reflect on it, it was the content churn of the pandemic and that massive spike in traffic, and then the constant chasing of something you knew you were never going to get back, which is people stuck indoors in April 2020, that was driving every publisher completely mad. Proper poison the water kind of stuff. And I think, like, at the end of 2021, I had the same thing you had, which is it was actually just tough to live in this. It wasn't just doing the job, it was doing the job under the circumstances. So yeah, I can totally see why you had the change, but, you know, well done for going back to it, frankly.
I know, looking at it, what's insane to me is how, you know, we were there in the middle of the bit of the zombie movie at the beginning, right, where all the news is about essentially the apocalypse, and yet the vast majority of people in the UK and the US were just like, oh, well, back to work. Like, we just carried on. I mean, looking back, I should have just been like, I'm taking 2 weeks off. We're in the middle of a pandemic. What are you talking about? But we all just got up and went to work at our kitchen tables. You know, it's sort of strange how much we all decided that normality just had to carry on. And then I think there was, across every industry, I think once things were beginning to return to normal, then we were all exhausted and we're like, oh God, like, we just, you know, it sort of all came and hit home afterwards. So yeah, I think there was a lot of, and yeah, it was a tough time to be on any website, I think, because any big corporation wants to see growth. And that was not a scenario, like you said, people being stuck indoors and suddenly interested in video games on a much larger scale. That was not a thing we could replicate, you know, no matter how many stories we wrote or things we did on the website. That was an anomaly.
Yeah. There'll never be this many people looking for where to buy a Nintendo Switch ever again. That was like the was that moment and no other.
Animal Crossing like was just, you know, therapy for the entire pandemic, I think. You know, that you couldn't do enough of that that content because people were relying on that as to sort of set the scene for their day.
Yeah, the flavour of my madness was just trying to hit Netflix news boxes, like Netflix shows, Netflix movies, hit those, and there's like 250,000 traffic in the bag, basically. And it was just like, oh my God, am I just going to do this while millions of people are dying? I guess I am. It's a strange period to look back on, because you're now far enough away that you can sort of look at it with a different perspective than when you're in it. And man, yeah. Sorry, a very bleak note to sort of take you down there, but it's definitely a real thing when you're working in media. So,
I do feel very blessed. You know, me and my fiance, we are indoor kids, right? So we had a lot of friends that suffered a lot more mentally than us, because actually staying in and playing video games and watching movies and not having to go out and socialise wasn't a huge blow to us the way it is to some people. You know, I mean, you could look at us now and be like, they're still living like it's the pandemic. And that's not for health reasons. That is just because we like being indoors with each other and our dog and playing video games. So, you know, we were lucky in that way.
Yeah. When we were setting this up, I was saying like, oh, is it okay to do midday your time? You're like, yeah, we don't go anywhere. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And I was like, well, you know, that's good for us. So I do appreciate it. But yeah. So I did want to ask a tiny bit more about Chicago on a lighter note. Like, does it have good sandwich shops as depicted in The Bear, or is that a filthy lie, do you feel?
No, it does. The food is really good, I will say. The food is amazing in Chicago. Especially, you know, we did California a lot of avocado, sushi, that kind of thing. Then we were in New York, which is a lot of everything, you know, very like fancy. And then we came to the Midwest, and it's just like, there is obviously, you know, there's a bunch of fancy restaurants here as well. But I would say like my favorite is that there's a lot of like down home, stick to your ribs, it's cold outside cooking, like, you know, stacks of pancakes and beautiful things done with potatoes and meat and yeah, big sandwiches, big pizzas. Oh. Yeah, it's really, we're not skinnier, I would say. It's it's delicious. And it's fascinating as well, because yeah, we moving to Chicago, we'd sort of we'd never really, you know, New York has pretty harsh winters, but it also has a subway, and you can kind of still go out and do your thing in New York and be out and about and never really have to see the outside. And Chicago is so cold, like so cold, and you just don't see anyone in winter because they're all at home ordering in food and, you know, trying to stay warm. But yeah, it's good. It's really good, big slabs of meat. And our street actually does, and you guys are always welcome to come visit our street in the summer. Just, it feels like every week there's some different kind of food festival. So there's like a burger festival where all, there's all these stands competing to be best burger. And there was Rib Fest.
Oh my God.
Rib Fest was one of them. Taco Fest. Yeah, it's really great.
That sounds so good. As you were saying that, I was getting increasingly cross about like just my life.
Oh, amazing. That sounds so good. You really made a good case for suburbia there, Rachel. That does sound good. Okay, well, glad to hear your Chicago life is working out so well. I did want to ask if there are any favourite articles from across your time, you know, like it's almost, I guess, 2 decades working in media. Is there anything that jumps out to you as you are particularly proud to have worked on this or that?
Yeah, I think probably in terms of just both incredibly fun to write and the sort of thing I would have wanted to read is probably my time on Glixel, just talking to people that I admired, like Nathan Fillion or Rahul Kohli, just about the games they loved. Being able to talk to someone about that the way that, you know, other people talk about sort of movies or books that have influenced them, it was really nice to feel like you were speaking to people who appreciated games as much as you did, and kind of and what, you know, were so excited to talk about them because no one ever asks them about that stuff, right? They ask them what movies they love, and but just that kind of feeling of, oh no, this is, you know, games, they're stories, they have as much of an emotional effect and an influence on people's lives. And I always say that to grumpy relatives that are like, you know, people, you know, kids should be like, you know, reading more, and I'm like, games are just a different way of telling stories, you know, they have as much impact as anything. It's just a different format.
Well, Nathan Fillion likes them, so what do you know?
Exactly. James Masters was probably the biggest one, because I got to ring my dad and say, Dad, we just spoke to Spike from Buffy. And that was like, that was just, I can't, yeah. I always like to think about, you know, what, am I living the life that like 12-year-old me would be proud of? And I think with that one, I could say yes.
Yeah, a cornerstone of millennial sexuality there, James Masters. Yeah. So, very good. what are you playing these days, Rachel, finally?
I am sort of putting off finishing Baldur's Gate 3, because even though I plan to do another playthrough, I've become locked in it. I don't know what to do. I know I'm going to have to make some half decisions about Asterion and stuff, and I'm not ready to. So I keep going back in, doing a little bit and then coming out. I'm back on the Fallouts, like most people, I think. I'm sort of interested in what's happening there. So I've gone back to Fallout New Vegas on my Steam Deck. And then I have a bunch of stuff that's kind of, I'm sort of always going at a bit in the background. Like Disney Dreamlight Valley, I find incredibly relaxing. I have a Red Dead Redemption 2 game that is just saved in the middle, so I can just go and do some fishing if I want to. that game will never progress. I finished it a few times, but that one will never change. That will just live in the middle. I will play anything, really. I'll download anything on Steam and give it a try. So sometimes I'm playing weird sim games. But yeah, at the moment it's really back on the Fallouts and Baldur's Gate when I can find the emotional strength.
Yeah, you're a classic games magazine generalist, you know. I feel like we've got very similar taste in that respect, you know. I'll just try and play everything and see how it goes, you know. It's sort of, it's the way to be, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, awesome. Thanks so much, Rachel. Where can people find your work these days then? Where do you recommend people finding you on social media and your stuff generally?
Yeah, much as I hate to admit it, probably like at the Rachel Weber on Twitter is still the easiest place to kind of find me. But yeah, then if you sort of IGN.com is where a lot of what I do lives now. But yeah, Twitter's usually the best place, even though I'm just waiting for that site to die. And the sooner it does, the better for all of us. But for now, I'm still trapped there.
Yeah, likewise. Spinning up the old blue sky on the side, but doesn't feel like it's going to happen for that one. So, yeah, it's tough. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on, Rachel. Really appreciate you sharing your experience.
No, thanks for having me. It's, you know, nice to chat to you and, yeah, come to Chicago, hang out.
Yeah, that would be awesome. It is, yeah, genuinely lovely to speak to you.
You could do a show from here.
That's where we do a live show.
Yeah, live from the Burger Festival down your street. That sounds perfect, actually. Awesome. Matthew, where can people find you on social media?
I am at @MrBasil_Pesto on Twitter and @MrBasilPesto, no underscore, on Blue Sky.
And I'm Samuel W. Roberts on both. And the Twitter for the podcast is BackpagePod, and also on Blue Sky, it's BackpagePod too. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.